morning. May it please the court.
Good morning.
Lisa Wright, Representative Mr. Faison. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Appellant has raised two new trial arguments and multiple sentencing arguments. And both the new trial arguments are very fact-intensive and I think fully set forth in the two briefs. And I do want to get to the sentencing arguments, which are also substantial. But just on the new trial arguments first, as to whether Mr. Faison validly waived counsel, the fundamental point here is that there was no waiver at all. Mr. Faison had said at one point that he wanted to waive counsel and represent himself, but that request was denied. The court appointed counsel Moore to represent him, and it was not until 4 months later that the court suddenly said it was granting Mr. Bisong's request without asking him if he wanted to give up the lawyer he'd had for the past 4 months. And our fundamental position is that this court cannot infer a valid waiver of a right as important as the right to counsel based on silence.
Are you implicitly critical of Mr. Moore's behavior in this case?
I think probably, yes.
Does that present a conflict of interest for you?
I don't think so, because I think certainly once Mr. Faison is pro se, of course he could not argue any ineffectiveness of standby counsel. So I think that would be part of the issue, and I didn't see that I was making the sort of...
Well, but Mr. Moore makes several statements indicating that the defendant is happy with the situation of representing himself under that hybrid situation. If Moore has incorrectly stated Mr. Bazong's position, then Mr. Moore is guilty of some kind of malpractice or negligence or something.
Well, I didn't view anything I was saying as criticizing Moore during the period that Moore was representing him. There's not much on the record about what
representing him, or he was in this halfway business.
Standby counsel. I don't think you have any right to any Sixth Amendment right at that point to effective assistance. So I don't see how I could.
Well, but Moore was communicating to the judge that the defendant was happy with the capacity to represent himself.
I mean, on the day the judge did it. Well, I mean, I'm not sure Mr. Moore did anything other than he stated, I think he wants to represent himself. And it was really at that point, I mean, I don't know that that could be deemed any kind of ineffectiveness.
We can't attribute to Mr. Faison Moore's statement about what Mr. Faison wants.
Well, I think Mr. Moore is stating what his understanding is.
Yeah, but if his understanding is wrong, then he's engaged in malpractice of some sort.
Well, not if it's a legitimately held understanding. I mean, but the point that's
why... Oh, I see. Moore has a legitimately held understanding that Mr. Faison doesn't want a separate lawyer, but that's an incorrect understanding on the part of Mr. Moore. I think you're in a hell of a spot as a basically arguing that another lawyer, another public defender is acting inappropriately.
Well,
first of all, I don't think he did, but I think...
Well, I think there are some criticisms that can be read in there, but I interpreted all those criticisms to be taking place at the point at which Mr. Faison had given up or had been made to give up the right to counsel. And I mean, the point about the Feretta waiver is that's why it's put on the record. It can't be done through counsel, really. I mean, that's the point. There has to be a direct colloquy with the defendant.
Well, there was, but then there was a question of whether it continued on.
Well, yeah, our position is at the end there was a silence from Mr. Faison.
He nodded his head a couple times.
He nodded his head throughout the discussion of how the trial would proceed with him as counsel, but as far as whether he wanted to give up counsel, that wasn't discussed. And I do think circumstances had changed significantly since the time when he had clearly expressed a preference for himself over Mr. Moore. Regarding the denial of appellant's right to see the discovery and prepare to defend himself.
How had circumstances changed?
Well, the trial was 3 weeks away. He had been moved outside the jurisdiction. There was no real prospect of access to the materials. So he's now really in quite a pickle if he wants to represent himself. At the time he said he wanted to represent himself, there was, you know, time to prepare. And also, he's had experience with Mr. Moore. I mean, we don't know what his view of Mr. Moore is at that point. We know that he was skeptical. Mr. Moore seems very busy, and he doesn't seem to have the background, but we don't know if Mr. Moore proved himself during that period or not.
You don't want us to take any notice of the proposition that public defenders, lawyers are not competent to handle these kind of criminal cases, do you?
No.
Isn't that on its face absurd?
No, but he is saying, I've spoken to Mr. Moore.
No, I'm talking about the question, the other argument you make, that he's put in this Hobson's choice because he's faced with a public defendant lawyer who isn't well-versed in immigration and economic transactions.
Well, he had specific concerns, and if they'd been fleshed out, perhaps they would have been shown to be meritless because a lot of criminal lawyers don't have such background knowledge. They learn it in the course of the case. That's part of being a criminal attorney.
We tend to rely on public defenders to be able to do that.
Of course, and all attorneys would take it upon themselves to master the necessary areas of the law, but the court didn't flesh that out for Mr. Bisong.
He said Mr. Moore's got the highest reputation, I think, the world of him.
Well, I trust him to tell me if there's a problem.
Right.
And that's where we see a problem, because Mr. Bisong has already talked to Mr. Moore and sees the problem. And if that conflict could have just been fleshed out there, it may be that you know, as in Cunningham, the whole thing would have disappeared.
Well, let me just be clear what your position is here, all right? Have you conceded that you are being implicitly critical of Mr. Moore on this record? And let me explain the context of that question. First of all, there's the joint pretrial statement where Mr. Moore and the prosecutors told the judge they needed to have a colloquy with Mr. Moore. Secondly, we do know from what Mr. Moore told the trial judge that Mr. Moore had been going to the U.S. Attorney's office reviewing the records. Now, we don't know that Mr. Moore conveyed all that to your client, but on the other hand, there's no reason to suggest he didn't. So what you wanted the district court to do here is precisely what? And what do you think that Supreme Court precedent requires the district court to do?
Now, are you referring to the criticisms of Mr. Moore?
No, I just want to be clear. I mean, I thought your point was that the Supreme Court Feretta precedent required an on-the-record questioning, and I'm sure the prosecutor is going to say, as he does in his brief, that, well, there was. You know, the district court and Mr. Moore and Mr. Bisong had some discussions in November and then later on in May. And if you add all that up, that's enough. And Judge Silberman's questions to you about Mr. Moore and his relationship and representations by representation of Mr. Bisong's position. Add all that up, and why isn't that enough to meet the Feretta standard?
Well, put simply, I mean, I think there was that discussion in November, which by the way, Mr. Moore, I think rightly at that point, when they say, what have you guys decided about representation, Moore steps aside and says, I'll let him address that. I mean, that's not really his place to be saying, but they do have a lengthy colloquy, but I guess my point is that in May there isn't really a discussion. All there is
Does there have to be another one,
what
I'm getting at.
Since Mr. Moore was appointed in the interim, yes, I think so, because he makes this request, it's denied. Then he's appointed counsel, and he has counsel. Then
the government argues he gets the best of both worlds. He has Mr. Moore working vigorously for him, looking at the documents in the U.S. Attorney's office and giving him presumably his best advice. And then the judge says, okay, you're going to be counsel now.
But I'm not sure there was no finding or request of Mr. Bisong of whether that's what he wanted. And giving up Mr. Moore at that point is a big deal, especially since he hasn't had access to any of the materials. As he says, he's at the Arlington County Jail one night, and he's filed a motion to continue, which he doesn't, apparently has not been sent the outcome of, and he's told, guess what, the trial's tomorrow and you're representing yourself. And then he gets into the situation that we talk about with the lack of access. The government's position is Feretta doesn't cover any kind of right to prepare, but it just seems that it must. I mean, because it's a meaningless right without that.
Well, that's your second argument.
Right. And what you were asking about the joint pretrial statement, and you said there had been an ongoing colloquy in May. I guess my fundamental position there is that there was not really a colloquy in May. If you read through what I think Mr. Bisong literally says, I believe nothing throughout the entire first part except yes and nodding to the understanding of the judge's description of the standing order, and then at the end says, okay, I haven't had any material, and that's all he says. I mean, it's true that he accepts what the court has done, but I don't think that's the same as choosing it or being asked if he's choosing it. On the second point, as I say, we believe the right to represent oneself would be meaningless if there was not some right to prepare. Obviously, there's a reasonableness limit on this, but we would suggest what occurred here crosses that line into unreasonableness. The Cain case, the government cites, really says nothing about that at all. It's a state habeas case. It's just looking at whether the Feretta itself clearly established this right, which we acknowledge it did not explicitly do so sufficiently for a state habeas petitioner to win. And once, also as to Rule 16, once Mr. Bisong became his own counsel, it's our position that Rule 16's right to inspect belonged to him, and it couldn't be discharged by having given access previously to his third party. And giving access to particular documents, which is what the court ordered that he identified, was essentially a denial of access where he made clear that he could not identify documents sight unseen. And there is no issue of manipulation here, as there frequently is in these pro se cases where people wait till the last minute and try to gum up the works and slow things up and get a continuance and all that sort of thing. That's not what was happening here, because he had been begging for the documents from the beginning, even when he was represented by Mr. Iwanage.
Do you want to discuss your leadership sentencing objection?
Yes, the leadership. We've challenged the leader points under both the immigration fraud group and the bank fraud group. The court had originally found Eldred Forna to be the only participant because he had participated in the preparation of the ETA 750s, which is obviously part of the immigration fraud. On the resentencing, we challenged Forna's knowledge and criminal intent there, and the court brought up these three other women who also helped. So there's four people identified as potential participants in the immigration fraud. The court didn't identify anybody as to the bank fraud. On the immigration fraud, it's our position there just isn't sufficient evidence that they knew that these documents were false or that they weren't authorized to sign names or whatever. And we think the McCoy case is very analogous. On the immigration fraud, the government has raised four people. It says that Agent Eichmann testified sufficiently to support leader participation by them, and we go through those in the reply brief, and there really is not sufficient evidence that they were in on this bank fraud or that it was anything other than a one-man operation. The checks, according to the government, were cut from Mr. Bisong's laptop computer. It appears to be sort of a side thing that's going on. The business is about churning out these 750s to get in by this April 30th deadline, and then these withdrawals are happening. Michelle Mead, you know, yes, certainly she was aware that people were unhappy, some people, and she was keeping very good records, apparently, of the complaints she was getting and then passing them on to Mr. Bisong. But if you have a situation where a receptionist is hearing clients say one thing, I didn't authorize, and Mr. Bisong is telling her, no, it's a misunderstanding, I don't think we can assume by preponderance that she didn't believe her boss and instead believed the people calling and therefore was criminally responsible, even if at some point, according to Eichmann, she did decide that Mr. Bisong was doing something wrong, but there's no indication of the timing of whether she stayed past that point. We know for a fact that Mr. Shimu left immediately upon deciding that this was not on the up and up. On the loss, I also feel we've got, there's just really insufficient evidence for more than, I would say, about $30,000 based on Agent Eichmann's testimony. It's really only about 40 people that she claims to have talked to, or that she did talk to, that said they didn't authorize it. It appears that you know, they found these notebooks with the complaints in them, and what it appears happened is that the people that complained were contacted and said, yes, I didn't authorize. It's not like these are just 40 random people and none of them authorized, therefore we can extrapolate from that. It seems like these were the people who had complained, so it's natural that they would say that. I don't know that we know much about the people who didn't complain and whether they authorized it or not. And the same argument, of course, applies to the 50 victims enhancement.
All right. Why don't we hear from the government?
Thank you.
Good morning. Stratton Strand on behalf of the government.
Good morning.
If I may address first the waiver issue. Appellant claims that he never requested to represent himself. Of course, at the December 11, 2002 ascertainment of counsel hearing, appellant specifically said, I would like Mr. Moore to assist me in the process, but I would like to represent myself. Clearly, he made a specific request. As of January 21, 2003, the court felt that he would be better served by being represented by Mr. Moore, and that
is... But the court said at that point, you're not serving yourself well.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. So then the government and the defense counsel filed this joint pretrial statement.
Correct.
And you're familiar with footnote 2?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how do you overcome that in this situation? Because the government is telling the district court there needs to be a colloquy.
The government is suggesting that should take place given the passage of time. The functional equivalent of another Feretta colloquy occurred on May 12, 2003 at the pretrial conference when Mr. Moore represented that Mr. Baisong still wished to represent himself, and then the court took appellant through a lengthy colloquy about all of its expectations for his conducting his own defense, and at each...
But the argument here is that Mr. Baisong was complaining that he had not seen the records. And the district court had tried to enable him to see the records, but its orders had not been complied with. So the question is, to the extent he was concerned about having a federal public defender represent him, because the federal public defender would not have the time to spend to do this, didn't the district court have some obligation to ascertain on the record what the situation was there?
Well, first of all, at the May 12 pretrial conference, appellant made no suggestion whatsoever that he was dissatisfied with counsel. In fact, to the contrary.
So the defendant has to make the affirmative statement on the record?
The defendant has to give some indication under Hall and Cunningham. The defendant has to give some sort of indication that...
But he has. I mean, he's written the judge letters. What I'm trying to understand is, the government and defense counsel say to the judge, you ought to have another colloquy with Mr. Baisong when they file their joint pretrial statement. And are you familiar with the record to the extent that, I mean, what happened? Did the judge just say, I don't need to do that? Or, I mean, there's nothing that I found, and the briefs don't tell me, that the judge ever responded to that one way or another.
Well, that footnote was a footnote to one of the many attachments to the pretrial statement. I'm not certain that the judge even saw that footnote. In any event, the question is, and even if the court did, which I think we can assume the court read carefully, I think if, to the extent that the claim is appellant was faced with a Hobson's choice, he was dissatisfied with counsel, that was never raised either in the footnote or by Mr. Baisong at the May 12 conference.
The footnote said that Feretta at least requires the district court to address the core concerns.
And the court had done that. The only concerns that appellant ever raised about Mr. Moore were on January 21st, 2003 at the status conference, mm-hmm. when the court insisted that Moore take over. And his only concerns were, I don't know that he's going to have the expertise in all these various areas that had nothing to do with the case.
Or the time.
And that was, of course, prospective. This is before Moore had done anything. And after that, Moore proceeded to demonstrate that he was highly competent. He went over, as Your Honor's questions have suggested, he went over to the U.S. Attorney's office 4 or 5 days, looking through every single box that the government had seized. He successfully obtained appellant's release on personal recognizance. He had demonstrated his his competence.
I understand your point, but counsel, in the opening argument to the jury, the defendant says, I had expected to have my record, so I can't, you know, do what I expected here. I mean, there is some indication that at least the defendant thought that whatever Mr. Moore had done was not enough to the extent of giving the defendant the ability to make the case he wanted to make to the jury. I mean, he says that in his opening argument to the jury.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor, I'm familiar with that. And I think what that relates to was his claim, which he made on June 2nd, at the first day of trial, that he hadn't had personal access to the records. His concern was not that my lawyer hasn't been doing what he's required to do. In fact, and the bottom line to all of this is, had appellant been dissatisfied with Moore on May 12th, he would not have asked that Mr. Moore continue as standby counsel. That's the end of the story.
Counsel, what troubles me is, why wouldn't the assistant U.S. attorney trying this case urge the judge to go through the cross the T and dot the I in May to make sure that the constitutional requirements were met, instead of letting it operate in a rather slapdash fashion? Isn't it the U.S. attorney's obligation to try to make sure that the case is clean as a whistle and that we are not faced with this trying to determine through the entrails of the goat what actually happened?
And I believe that the U.S. attorney attempted to do that with the footnote.
That's not enough. He could have got a, look, Your Honor, please go through the procedure again so that it's crystal clear that the defendant knows exactly what the consequences of representing himself are and get a clear indication on the record that he wishes. To a certain extent, the defendant is playing games here and keeping it confusing.
Absolutely.
Why isn't the U.S. attorney obliged to get it crystal clear so we don't even have to worry about it?
Two responses, Your Honor. The U.S. attorney knew that on November 25th, the court had gone through a model Feretta colloquy.
But now there are several changes and months have gone by.
Secondly, the circumstances that existed at the time of the May 12th hearing, I think, made it pretty clear to the assistant who was there that
why not make it crystal clear?
That hindsight is 20/20. But the question is whether the record, I'm not trying to duck Your Honor's question. I also have counsel sitting at table next to me, and I think that the colloquy that occurred made a record, which is, of course, what the requirement is. It could have been more explicit, but the question under Bailey is, was there enough on the record for this court to be confident that this was a knowing and voluntary waiver? And it was. And the fact that the assistant didn't impose on the judge to do more than the judge was already doing is not ultimately relevant to the disposition of the issue. Again, the appellant specifically requested, the nub of this claim is that this was a Hobson's choice. And of course it wasn't a Hobson's choice because appellant raised no concerns about Mr. Moore at the time that the court granted and specifically requested that Mr. Moore continue his standby counsel. And then he and Mr. Moore, the trial performance bears out that this was in fact exactly the choice, because at trial, Mr. Moore and appellant worked as a team with the exact division of labor that they had proposed at the May 12th conference. So again, the record is absolutely clear. This is what Mr. Moore and appellant intended, and they got exactly what they wanted, which was hybrid representation, where appellant was able to stand in front of the jury and say, look at me, I'm innocent, I'm representing myself, I'm so sure I'm innocent, while at the same time having the able representation of experienced counsel. And that in itself satisfied Feretta, irrespective of any issues of knowing and voluntary waiver.
That satisfies Feretta once you get over the knowing and voluntary.
Well, our argument as under Arroyo, which of course is a backup argument that the court need not get to, but is it counsel was actually provided here because Mr. Moore satisfied functionally as counsel given the unusual extent to which he was involved in this.
But this is not an ineffective assistance of counsel case. That's not what we're arguing here.
No, I'm
that's
saying
that's not what counsel's arguing here or what we're trying to explore.
I'm
just what was the district court required to do in order to assure that the defendant was making a knowing and voluntary waiver. And here, what is it, 3 weeks before trial, he's told he's counsel, he still hasn't seen the records that he says, he needs to see because he thinks he's innocent, and if he can get his records, he'll be able to prove it to the jury. I mean, that's what he's told the judge.
It goes to his claim that he lacked personal access. It's not his claim that his lawyer
counsel, that's my point, is that in these other cases we've had, the district court has done something to assure the defendant that either you're operating under a misapprehension or, in fact, your attorney, has taken care of this so you don't need to worry. Where do we have anything like that in this case?
Well, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. Again,
that was a question.
Let me start again. The question is, yes, there was something like that on the record. I don't believe that was the nature of what appellant was raising then. He wasn't complaining about his lawyer right then. But even if you had construed it as that, on May 12th, when appellant complained of a lack of access to personal access to records, the court specifically set up, questioned Mr. Moore about that, performed an inquiry, and Mr. Moore assured the court that he was going to be going both that Friday and the following Monday to the U.S. Attorney's Office to review the boxes and pull the documents that appellant had said he wanted. And the court then addressed Mr. Moore and said, okay, you have been told by Mr. Bisong what it is that he wants. You are going to do that. And I expect that to occur. So, yes, the court did address that specific concern.
I was trying to make it clear that it's not a question of whether the district court didn't issue orders to try to make these things happen, but in fact they didn't happen. Mr. Moore told the judge that he was unable to get the records to his client because he was in this Virginia facility and he wasn't a member of the Virginia bar.
Well, on May 12th, what Mr. Moore represented was that he would be going back to the U.S. Attorney's Office to pull the documents that appellant had requested, and that in fact did occur.
No, and Mr. Moore told the judge that when Mr. Moore was in the Virginia facility, because of the Virginia rule, he was unable to get the documents to his client.
To his client, exactly. We're speaking at cross purposes. He had gotten them himself, but hadn't yet been able to give them to Mr. Moore. So then we fast forward to June 2nd, the beginning of trial. What does the court do when it is apprised that that appellant has not yet had the opportunity to review the documents that Mr. Moore pulled for him at his request? Well, it convenes a discussion with counsel. It tells government, look, government, you are to provide to appellant any documents or sets of documents or boxes, categories of documents that he wishes to review. You are to provide them to Mr. Moore, who will provide them to appellant. That was the arrangement that the court set up on June 2nd, and neither
trial started June 3rd.
The trial had been scheduled to begin June 2nd. The court pushed it off until June 3rd to allow appellant some time to review the discovery documents, which of course are different from the boxes. But the court set up a procedure. A question here is, was there an abuse of discretion in the way the court handled this discovery issue?
No, there's a Faretta question. That's all I'm focusing on in my questions to you. He wants to see these documents the day before trial is to start. And can we take judicial notice of how long it takes to get a prisoner from the courthouse back to the jail and all that? So, it's not as though he had pure time. And we've got at least, three boxes that it started at 171 boxes and then it turned to, three boxes of documents that had been called?
Well, there were three boxes of discovery, which appellant acknowledged at the sentencing hearing he had actually received 8 months before.
That's when his private attorney gave the documents?
Exactly.
Okay.
So he had already seen those, of course. And the question as to the access to boxes, again, I don't see that, and I don't understand appellant to be arguing that the access to boxes was somehow a Hobson's choice involving his attorney. And in any event, the fact is that with standby counsel remaining in the case and remaining to assist him, appellant did not lose the value of Moore's access to all of those documents. And if you look at the trial, it's apparent that Moore was handing appellant the documents that he needed for cross-examination, assisting him with deciding which exhibits to use. Appellant and Mr. Moore marked 66 exhibits in their cross-examination and their direct defense. It is absolutely apparent that appellant had access to every document he needed, and of course, even on appeal, he has yet to identify a single document that he claims would have been useful to his defense.
Of course, he doesn't have to, does he, counsel? Because this isn't a harmless error question.
Well, I understood you have moved on to the discovery issue.
No, I'm still at Ferretta. Counsel, what about the leader role in the sentencing? Can you discuss that with me? What's the standard there?
Whether the appellant was a leader of one or more other participants. The trial court found that there were five participants in the immigration fraud, and there was evidence to support that. Eichmann's testimony that these employees knew that the companies that were supposedly sponsoring the clients were fictitious companies, and despite knowing that, they signed off on the ETA 750s.
What about the bank fraud?
And then as to the bank fraud, Maria Sebastian was one of the employees, the paralegal, who was found to be a participant in the immigration fraud. And she was also, there was testimony from Eichmann that she was one of the ones who had concluded that what Mr. Bison was doing with regard to the 350 problem, with regard to the bank fraud checks, was illegal, and yet she continued to serve Mr. Bisong and participate in the immigration fraud. And as the trial court found, the two schemes were part and parcel of one large scheme. So an employee participating in the knowingly participating in the immigration fraud and knowing that the same clients were involved in both frauds is knowingly advancing the purposes of the bank fraud as well. So all of those employees who were participating in the immigration fraud, knowing that what was going on was illegal and knowing that appellant was defrauding these same clients in bank fraud, were also participants within the meaning of the enhancement.
Well, you've elided there very quickly from Mrs. Sebastian to the other four. But you're saying, who is this agent?
Agent Eichmann.
Who, agent of what?
She's a criminal investigator, Your Honor.
For whom?
She works for the U.S. Attorney's Office.
All right, so she's a Justice Department employee?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. So she says that Mrs. Sebastian, she interviewed Mrs. Sebastian, and Mrs. Sebastian told her?
She interviewed Mrs. Sebastian. She interviewed all of these employees, and she...
But Mrs. Sebastian is the key here, isn't it? I mean, because the other employees are doing the immigration, and we're talking about the bank part of it. And I know you want to lump them together, but... You heard counsel's argument about that. So I just want to understand what you think the standard that is that the judge has to apply.
The question on appellate review is whether the trial court's factual finding here
applied the correct standard. All right, so that's what I'm trying to find out, what you think the correct standard is.
The preponderance of the evidence standard.
No. Impose a leader role in handling.
Oh, I see.
What is the standard that the judge has to find or apply in order to make the proper findings?
That there is one or more participant, and a participant is one who is criminally responsible, whether or not that person is charged.
So you've got Mrs. Sebastian. That's your key here.
But Mrs. Sebastian is enough, but the... we also have a lot of evidence that everybody working in this very small office was aware of the extent of the bank fraud and aware that this was not a legitimate operation. This was two small rooms, and there were binders and binders of 350 letter complaints and 350 telephone messages. It was known as the 350 problem because there were so many complaints. All of the employees who are participating in the immigration fraud know also that Mr. Rysong is participating, is conducting a bank fraud. And in any event, Maria Sebastian herself is enough to support the trial court's finding.
And this is all before the district court because of Agent Eichmann's testimony?
Well, Agent Eichmann's testimony was as to the conversations that she had had with the employees of Mr. Baisong's AIA company, but there was a lot of other the evidence of the 350s, all of that evidence, the size of the offices, the fact that this was not a legitimate company, the fact that the companies themselves were fictitious, all of that was trial evidence.
I get that. That's the immigration part. I want to know, it's because of Agent Eichmann's testimony about what Mrs. Sebastian told her, namely that she continued to aid and abet Mr. Baisong in the check fraud?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
I would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you, Your Honors.
If I could just quickly follow up on that leader's material. Ms. Sebastian, I believe I heard Mr. Strand say that Ms. Sebastian was found to be a participant in the immigration fraud. That's not correct. It was the two Ebwe sisters and Ms. Hashim, and then Mr. Forna. Those were the four. Ms. Sebastian, I've just quickly looked up, I think this is the only testimony about her from Eichmann. Who is Maria Sebastian? She was hired by Baisong to be a paralegal at AIA. Do you have a general time frame? Began working there June 2001. What was she asked to do? Keep pushing the ETA 750s, you know, through the process to follow up Department of Employment Services to interact with the clients related to those 750s. She testified at Forna's trial, did she not? Yes, but she did not testify at Baisong's, is that correct? Yes. And did there come a point in time, based on any statement that Ms. Sebastian made to you or in this courtroom, Mr. Forna's trial, did there come a point in time when Sebastian became aware that what Mr. Baisong was doing was wrong and illegal? Yes. And then they move on to Michelle Mead. I don't see anything in there that says that she knew that the 750s were problematic at the time she was working on them. And there is the testimony from one of the clients that a Maria from accounting acted evasive when asked about the $250, and that she sent her to Sylvia, or then she then got a call from Sylvia.
You say your strongest argument on sentencing is on the leader enhancement?
The leader, also the loss and the number of victims. I don't understand how there's any support for those. Also, I think the administrative order argument is quite strong as well. And certainly the leader as to the bank fraud. I'm not sure I answered the court's questions about Mr. Moore as well as I should have, but I want to make the point that this is the issue of a conflict was not thought of. I mean, if I thought there was any argument that Mr. Moore had been ineffective, Mr. Kramer would have appointed someone else. That happens all the time. So I thought about it in terms of what he did before May 12th, during which time he had an obligation to provide effective assistance, and then what happened afterwards. And we have to remember that at the time that perhaps Mr. Baisong is not aware of everything that's going on, he's down in Southern Virginia, Mr. Moore thinks that he's going to be in charge of the case. It's his job to run the case. It's his job to decide how informed to keep Mr. Baisong. He doesn't know at that point necessarily that Baisong is going to have it put on him. And then at that time, they all still think there's going to be a week to prepare. So I just want to make that point. I didn't see the government refers to requests for standby counsel on May 12th and a division of labor that was proposed and all that. I don't read the May 12th colloquy as Mr. Baisong involved in anything like that. I mean, he doesn't say anything other than he can read and write English.
Nods his head
to the requirements for how the trial is going to be run. And he says he can read and write English. And then at the end he says, Your Honor, please, I don't have any of the documents. That's about it. this issue of the three boxes, I don't think I mentioned this in the reply, and I cannot find the quote right now. The government says that Mr. Bisong at sentencing acknowledged getting, I think, three boxes. And I did just this morning see that part where he says the two boxes. But I think when I read it this morning, well, I can't find it now, the next sentence makes pretty clear. I don't think he is saying that he has personally seen it. That's not my interpretation of the government's citation to that sentencing transcript. I mean, Mr. Moore comes in and says on the day of trial, as to him having seen the documents, that hasn't happened. And I think there's an explanation for that, is that he thinks he's going to be counsel, and he's not necessarily providing Mr. Bisong with everything. And then he thinks he's going to see him up here, and then that doesn't happen. And so that's how that came to pass, I think.
Anything further?
Oh, I just wanted to say on the access issue that the fact that, I mean, what's troubling to me about the access issue, it really fundamentally, is that it appears that counsel was kept in the case to avoid the complications that come with having someone have to prepare their own defense. And then he's removed at the last minute, and that's what put us in this situation. And I just don't think that's a reasonable way to proceed. If it's intended that Mr. Bisong was ultimately going to be allowed to represent himself, he should have been allowed to prepare instead of keeping this placeholder in for these many months while he could have been working on getting the case together. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.